Well, it really is hard without the light, but we'll do our best. Okay. Yeah, you can, sure, absolutely. Come. So, Zach, you want to have him move it up? So remember I told you about 3 weeks ago to really invest as much as you possibly could in Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaTzmaut, because it's unlike anything you've had in America. So I hope I proved my point, and hope you can remember how meaningful and how transformative, it was. And to a degree, it's an uphill battle, because when you live in Chutz Laaretz, sometimes you barely have Yom HaZikaron, Yom HaTzmaut ceremonies. And when they do exist, especially Yom HaZikaron, by definition, they're dry, because you're not sitting in cemeteries, you're not helping bereaved families. It's very abstract, as it, there's no choice, it's no one's fault. And Yom HaTzmaut is very detached. Yom Yerushalayim is even different, because Yom Yerushalayim is a very, very skinny day. It's a lanky day. What do you mean it's a skinny day? Because even in Israel, very few people note or in any way commemorate Yom Yerushalayim. So the secular Jews don't celebrate it, for reasons that we'll talk about a little bit tonight, additional reasons. Obviously, Haredim, they don't celebrate Yom HaTzmaut, they don't celebrate Yom Yerushalayim, although there is some wiggle room there as well. And because it's not a national holiday, so even Dati Lomi people go to work. So this year it's Friday, it's a little bit different. So basically it's a very, very, very small demographic that invests in Yom Yerushalayim. It's basically kids, yeshiva bachurim, seminary students, overseas. It's and you'll see this, all the events will take place. It's very young and it's very kid-oriented. Again, this year a little different because it's Erev Shabbos and most people are off. So it means that you have to try to take the concepts and the imagery and the symbolism and at least for the rest of your life, every year when Chaf Chet Iyar comes, something. I mean, whether it means reading a book or whether it means looking at some movie or whether it means obviously going to shul, to a program or something. It's even harder in some ways, Yom HaTzmaut, where there's a rush and a thrill and speakers are coming and you see the pictures of Israel and the Kotel and you go, here in Yerushalayim is very much special. I mean, you're in Chutz Laaretz, internal and personal and quiet, but in many ways, what we are celebrating on Yom Yerushalayim, in many ways, and I hope to clarify that for you tonight, far, far, far surpasses anything that we celebrated during Yom HaTzmaut. Okay? We may have to move. You know what? Let's maybe move to the other room and see if the lights are on, because it's going to get dark here soon. Go to Mordechai's room. If the lights are on, we'll move before, just see if it works, before it gets to be a big, you know, big disruption, because it's going to get dark here, and then it's going to be hard for people to see and hard for me to see you. So the lights are on, we'll just move over. Okay? But that was your vibe to move over anyway, even into my room. So let's move and we'll try to find a place. Very appropriate to Yom Yerushalayim. We're going home. Celebrating Yom Yerushalayim is to make a brisker chakira. We've all been in yeshiva long enough. Most briskers probably wouldn't be happy with that. For me to hijack brisker chakiras and apply it to ideology, but it makes sense in this context. Tzvei dinim. You have to be mechal between two halachas of Yom Yerushalayim. One halacha is called the Six-Day War. The other halacha is called coming back to Yerushalayim. Because there are two totally separate events, each of humongous magnitude, that happened to overlap onto the same 6 days in Jewish history in June 1967. And the only way you'll appreciate the magnitude of each is if you totally cleave them apart and you deal with them separately. So let's make believe that in 1967 we didn't return to Yerushalayim. And in 1967, we didn't return to Gush. In 1967, we didn't return to Shechem. You'd still have reason to celebrate what happened in 1967. So let's call it two separate days. Let's talk about 2 days that we're going to celebrate in one. We're going to celebrate Yom Milchemet Sheshet Hayamim. And we're also going to celebrate Yom Yerushalayim. We'll talk about what Yerushalayim means. But let's ignore Yerushalayim, not mention the word. Don't just say the word, and then we'll talk about Yom Yerushalayim. In 1967, the state of Israel almost collapsed. People look back at that and they rewrite the war in its false historical revisionism, because the war led to the return of the Jewish people to Yudan Shimon and to Yerushalayim, and we'll talk about that later, and the political hot potato that created. And therefore, the war that launched it all has been colored and totally, totally different and completely false use. In 1967, General Nasser, who was the head of the Egyptian army, who was the ruler of Egypt, strongman of Egypt, collected all the Arab armies, the Jordanian and Syrian armies, under his joint command, threw the UN peacekeeping forces out of the Suez Canal, which was the border between Israel and Egypt,
And hurled a threat, which lives in infamy, which we laugh at because it's a funny, funny historical artifact, but believe me, to people living in 1967, it wasn't funny. You can look it up. He threatened to hurl the Jews into the sea. That was his famous, nefarious quote. Yeah, we laugh at it. I was going to hurl Israel into the sea. Going back to 1967, you're not laughing. 19 years since the State of Israel. About 23, 24 after the Holocaust. This was seen as the second wave of the Holocaust. That's how it was being presented, and that's how it was seen. And believe me, those 18, 19 years between 1948 and 1967 were not years of prosperity. They weren't years of high tech. It's not the Israeli country you know today. We'll talk about that a little bit later. These were years of diplomatic isolation. These were years of economic austerity. You speak to people during that period, they actually had food stamps. To bring your food stamps to get your weekly loaf of bread, your weekly bag of rice, your weekly bag of sugar. Diplomatic isolation. More people emigrated from Israel than immigrated to Israel during that period. The doors were swinging one way because it was. So, everyone has stories. I'm sure half of you in this room have stories of people. I mean, my family, my father-in-law is a Palestinian. What does that mean? He's a Palestinian. He lived in Palestine before 48. He lived a couple years afterwards, I think in 1951, 52. Before they turned it from Palestine passports into Israel, he left because it was too hard. His father left. They moved to Queens. Thank God I met my wife that way, or else he would have been in Israel. You can't imagine how fledgling and how weak the country was. People feared a Holocaust. Women and children were being put back on flights in the weeks and the months before June 67, just to get them out of the way so that they were digging mass graves in public parks. They were calculating, how can we survive the war with reasonable, tolerable casualties so that we can still maintain this country? 50,000, 80,000, 90,000, those are figures being thrown around. No one was thinking about returning to Yerushalayim. There's the last thing in people's minds. You know, when you're a general, your job is to game plan for every single possibility, as remote as it seems, because in the heat of the struggle, the heat of the battle, it's hard to think on your feet. So you think about every possibility, and the military stations people in the room to think out of the box, to think crazy, crazy thoughts, just to see if we can stretch our imagination. And none of the military generals in their wildest dreams, and it's their job to have wild dreams, thought about Yerushalayim, that we pleaded with the Jordanians, not your war. We're fighting Egyptians to the south, fighting Syrians in the north. Just stay out of the battle. It's not your war. Of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu climbed into psychology, into the heart of general of King Hussein as he climbed into Pharaoh's heart. And Nasser duped him. He telegraphed him. He duped him into thinking that Egyptian tank divisions were marching on Tel Aviv when they were being surrounded in the Sinai Desert surrendering. And he said, join us in the war. And Hussein joined the war, thinking that he was joining towards the end, just coming in for the save and sharing the loot. And he didn't realize he was getting into it within a few days. We'll talk about the return, but that wasn't on the agenda. That wasn't on the table. Yerushalayim, who in their wildest minds? The proof of that is, had we thought about it in advance, it would be more likely that we would have annexed the lands. That would have solved the last 75 years of political skirmishing and whatever. We just didn't. No one was prepared for it. I'm not saying whether I'm not commenting on the current state, but that I'm just. It's indicative of no one even thinking in those terms. People came to school. All the schools, Haredi schools, secular schools to a degree, Datilomi schools, for weeks and weeks. There were no courses, there were no papers, there were no tests. They came in, 5 hours of telling, they went home. I've spoken to people who lived through those events. My aunt was sent to Belgium, with her kids. That's how frightened my grandparents were in 1967. There was a gallows humor. Again, one of these old jokes that I'm old enough to have heard. I came to Yeshiva about 16 years after this happened. But to me, it was still fresh. I was still hearing these stories, meeting the people. The old joke was, the last person to leave Ben-Gurion should shut the lights out. Namely, at some point, this whole little fantasy called the State of Israel is going to end. The last person to leave, shut the lights out. You know, make sure you close things up and put little things together once the country closes. And then out of nowhere. And we were all alone. Don't think that we had strong military support from the United States. All that support started after 67. In 1967, we returned to the situation that Avram Avinu stood in. Kol ha'olam kulo mitzad echad shel hanar, ba'avram mitzad sheni shel hanar. We stood completely and totally alone like our grandfather Avram. It was Sefer Bereishis once again. And it was Parshas Bereishis once again. Ki sheishis yamim asa Hashem asa shemayim v'yasaretz. In 6 days Hashem created the cosmos. And in 1967, ki sheishis yamim asa Hashem, Hashem recreated modern history. It was Maisa Bereishis. Rav Unterman, who was a Rav HaRashi during the Six-Day War in Israel, paskined that even if you don't recite Hallel during Yom HaTzmut for whatever reason, because you don't feel ideologically aligned and you don't feel that halachically just, whatever the shittas are, you should say Hallel. And there are people today that paskin like Rav Unterman. You'll find people who don't say Hallel on Yom HaTzmut, but do say Hallel on Yom Yushalayim, not because of Yom Yushalayim and any ideology or what it means, and I'll tell you later what I think it means, but simply may I fail the hour, Mishiva Lagul. Sabuni Gam Sabuni, Mishem Hashem Kiami Lam, Sabuni Chidvarim, Dacho Kiesh Kutsim, Mishem Hashem Kiami Lam, Dacho Dechisan and the Apav, Hashem Azarani, Mes Hashem Isis, I'll see you for us, Bein Einu. So before you let your imaginations run wild and get to what the larger symbolisms and the iconic value of Yushalayim, forget it. It was just a military victory that was far more miraculous and far more decisive and than anything that 48 could demonstrate. Because in 48 it was a compromise and an armistice, and we survived and we prevented, but on the other hand we lost large chunks. It wasn't this miraculous, immaculate victory. 67 was. It was just the timelines. The battles are still studied in West Point, in military installations, in military schools. Military cadets are studying, how could this ragtag, how could they defeat 6 days? 6 days, the entire map of the world was changed. That started the Western defeat of the Soviet Union. We'll talk about that a little bit later. It wasn't just Israel that changed. The whole world changed in 6 days. So before we talk about Yerushalayim, just try to put Mechamed Yom Sheshetayimim on the side and think about that. And think about and as the years go on, and the best thing I can tell you is just simply pick up a book. Read Rav Yoel Ben Nun's Like Dreamers and his book, the book he's in. So many good books are actually coming out with a movie in the next 2-3 years. They're coming out with a Hollywood production on the Six-Day War. So just read and just the war, just the details, and the miracles, and the nisim, and zeh yom asa Hashem nagila v'nisim chavav. Now, of course, there's the second part, and that's what I'm here to talk with you about. But I want you to forget the first part. The Gemara and Brachos, let's quote some Gemara and Brachos, source number one. Has a machlokus, how does the third bracha of benching conclude? The first bracha, berachas amazon, al haaretz v'al mazon. First bracha, al haaretz v'al mazon. Second bracha. Third bracha, how should it conclude? So we conclude Bani Shalayim, Bani Baracham of Yishalayim. There's a dissenting opinion. Tan Rabbanan, Malchosin. V'yos v'yidamer Moshia Yisrael. V'yos v'yid the source number one feels you should say Hashem rescues and saves and redeems the Jewish people. The Gemara like slams its fist on the table. What do you mean, V'yos v'yidamer Moshia Yisrael in Bani Yishalayim lo? You're going to talk about Jewish redemption and not mention Yishalayim? Like, it's impossible. I could just say a bracha about Geula without mentioning Yerushalayim. It's unfathomable. So he said, I mean that. Like, don't jump down my throat. I meant also Moshiach Yisrael. I meant don't just say Yerushalayim, but be more explicit, say Moshiach Yisrael. But like no one in the Gemara's discussion even considers the option of discussing Geula without Yerushalayim. Namely, Geula Yisrael does not happen without Yerushalayim. It's the first bell. It's the portal. It's the foundation. Without Yerushalayim, Gula doesn't start. And that's why it's unfathomable to the Gemara that you should say Moshiach Yisrael without saying Boni Yerushalayim. So what about Yerushalayim starts Gula? So let's divide this into four. We'll talk about four different impacts of Yerushalayim on the Gula process. Number one. Okay, get ready for a funny Rambam. Now you wouldn't really think the Rambam is funny. And if I told you it's a funny Rambam from the Mar Nevuchim, then you'd be even more surprised, because the Mar Nevuchim is a heavy, heavy work. What's funny? He's not telling jokes in the Mar Nevuchim. But get ready for a funny Rambam. You're all going to laugh. Turn the page, source number 13, Mar Nevuchim. Here it is. This is what people like me find funny. Okay, it's the Mar Nevuchim. Shem says, you know why Yerushalayim doesn't appear in the Torah? The word Yerushalayim doesn't appear at all in the Torah. There are different references to the mountain, to the place, but the word Yerushalayim does. So, for all intents and purposes, we don't really know where the Beis Hashem is. And in Tanakh, Yerushalayim is mentioned, but also sparingly. But when I come out and say, this is my place, this is my home, Hashem says. So the Rambam says, you know why? Because if it were revealed, then the Goyim would spend all their time fighting over it and destroying one another and killing each other for it. So Hashem says, you know what? I'll keep it private so that there are no wars in Yerushalayim. How did that work out? Not so great. What's the point of the Rambam? Why? I'm supposed to laugh now. Now's the funny part. What's the point? The point is, from the dawn of time, there is a knowing knowledge lodged at the subconscious heart of humanity. And this is where history began. This is where Hashem took the dust from the Har HaBayis and created humanity from. And this is where history will end. This is where the entire process of human history will stream towards. And everyone will gather in Yerushalayim, whether it be for apocalyptic wars, for the arrival of Moshiach, for the Beis Hashem, for the light of Hashem's knowledge. This is the epicenter of the human experience. And there are metaphysical forces, as we said so often, that operate on the human experience that are undetectable and undiscernible. Now, where the definition and the balance between metaphysics and human free choice lies is an interesting question, but there are forces in this world, such as anti-Semitism, there are forces. And people know that this is where HaKadosh Baruch Hu's presence lies, and this is why all religions are attracted to it. And this is why even before there were religions. What does the Medrash say? The Rambam actually quotes this Medrash, but I'll just read it to you from the Medrash. Source number 8. Rabbi Yeshua, the Sichlin of Shem Levi, what were Cain and Hevel fighting over? Greed. Enough to go around. Tell you what, you take China, I'll throw in India. You in America, I'll throw, I don't know, you two people in the world. Tell you, there's enough for everyone, enough to go around. Enough money, enough food, enough people. What are you fighting over? What are they possibly fighting over? You got enough land, you got enough money, you've got... So the Medrash says, Shneim source them right not lo takarkos. They both had enough land from here to Wazoo. Shneim not lo simitalpin. They each had enough belongings and possessions from here ad nauseam. Al mahayimadainim. What's the big fight about? El azel me betchumi beisam mikdash nivne. I want Yerushalayim. Nothing's changed. I don't care. You can take the whole world. I want Yerushalayim. You can take, I want Yerushalayim. I'm going to kill you over it. Because Cain and Hevel knew better than anyone else because they lived so proximate to the birth of humanity that that's where humanity originated from. When the Jewish people marched into Yerushalayim in 1967, humanity shuddered. Some of humanity shuddered in a very, very happy way. Some humanity shuddered in a very antagonistic way. When Jews returned in 1948 to Israel, to Haifa, to Tel Aviv, to Ashdod, to Ashkelon, no one shuddered. In fact, they were all pretty happy because it solved two problems. It solved the world's guilty conscience after the Holocaust. We now are giving something to the Jews. And it solved a real logistical issue called Jewish refugees who had no place to settle. You've seen the black and white footage of ships being turned away. So 48 was Zenene v'ze lochaser, Zenene v'zenene. Everyone's happy. Everyone's more or less happy. The Jews have theirs. The Arabs have theirs. Refugees have their place, cut up like a salami. No one really got angry. Arabs were angry, but the world opinion was fairly neutral. 1967, when our paratroopers march into Yerushalayim and see the footage, take the time to YouTube it. So when you walk in Yerushalayim on Friday, you'll actually know where you're walking and see those bullet holes, you'll know what those bullet holes are a product of. Then the following nevuah came true. The nevuah of Az Yashir. I quoted to you, source number 6, Shamu Amim Yergazim. The nations heard about that, they got really angry. They got really shooken up. Chila Chazi Yashrei Peloshes. Aznif Halu Lufay Adam. Elei Mor B'Yachazemra. Namogu Kor Tipo Ayim Ozefacha. Bigdol Zechamim. Ad Yavar Mecha Hashem. Ad Yavar Zechonisa. Teve'em Ovis Teve'em Ovahar Nachal Ascham Machon Lashivtecha. We march to Yerushalayim, Shamu Amim Yergazim. No one's neutral. I last night spoke to some, I don't know, Christian podcast network. They had me speaking to them, some super popular pastor, I don't know what his name is. And he could be more supportive of Israel, more supportive of the children of God, more supportive. It's hard to know how to process this. We don't really have a Masara because for the last 2,000 years, unfortunately, Christians weren't highly enthusiastic in supporting us. At best, they let us live. most of the time they're antagonistic. So it's hard to know. Some people feel it won't be part of their narrative. Some people feel like this may be a sign of rapprochement between Yaakov and Esau, but it's hard to really know. But at least they're supporting us. They're not antagonistic. They're supporting us politically, financially, emotionally. Much of the world is opposed to us. But no one's neutral about Yerushalayim. And everyone knows that's where history will end. And all these skirmishes in Gaza, and all these wars in Lebanon, and all the intrigue and drama in Tehran, it's all about Yerushalayim. All the newspapers, all the pictures, all the the military units, Al-Quds unit, and all the missile shot because of what happens in the Har HaBayis, and there's a flag march or not a flag march, without getting into the politics of whether it's right or not right, but all the current events that are unfolding are just reflective of our nevuos. Now what happens in Yerushalayim indicates and symbolizes that Mashiach is coming and that history is accelerating, that the wheels of history are turning and that we're moving forward and that we're no longer stuck in the mud in the way that 48 didn't. Because until you have Yerushalayim, there's no gula to speak of. Moshiach Yisrael and gula, you're starting, you're stabilizing the Jewish people, you're letting them come back. But once we return to Yerushalayim, once we return to the Beis Hashem and Shara, and Beis Elokim and Shara Shemayim, then gula starts moving forward. And that's the first impact. That all of a sudden our posture shifted. We'll talk about our posture internationally a little bit later if we have time. The second impact. What happened to not people looking at the Jewish people from the outside, but to our people and our nation? So let's read a pasuk in a drasha, which we'll go back to again and again. Source number 15. In Tehillim Kuf Chaf Beis, Yerushalayim is called Yerushalayim HaBinuya, very famous phrase, Ki'ir Shechubra LaYachdav. What does Chubra LaYachdav mean? Everyone is united. Why is Yerushalayim a city of unity? Well, in a very legal sense, because Yerushalayim wasn't allocated to one Shevet. He said, Yerushalayim, lo nischaka l'shevotim. That's why you can't have a din of Matbeis Mitzara, can't have a din of Yerani Da'a, certain halachas not apply Yerushalayim, because it didn't belong to any one Shevet. For obvious reasons, Hashem didn't want to situate his Beis HaMikdash in the area of one Shevet, because then people would claim, we have the truth. We have a monopoly of the truth. Dan would say to God, you're not really from because Hashem lives with us and he agrees with us. There's no monopoly to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. No human being can make claim that I know how to serve Hashem, and this is the way to learn Torah, and this is the way to be an Oved Hashem. There are different approaches. Everyone finds their own approach. But Hashem says, the Beis HaMikdash is going to be in Washington, D.C. Americans know what I'm talking about. No longer to anyone say, what's it called? Federalized location, federalized city. It's not like a federalized city. That's why it wasn't conquered until a very late stage, until there was a federal government. Until there was a Melech, there can't be a federal area, because then it just has to... has to revert to Shvatim. Once David achieves Malchus, then he conquers Yerushalayim, and then the Beis HaMikdash can be constructed. But there's more than just it's not allocated to one Shevet. Something about Yerushalayim creates unity amongst the Jewish people. Something about Yerushalayim melts away the differences, melts away the antagonism, melts away. You speak to people who march down to the Kotel and march through Yerushalayim. That first Shavuos, where 400,000 people went to the Kotel. Remember, Shavuos was a week after, so fresh, it was Ruah. 400,000 people descended on the Kotel. Everyone felt something. Everyone felt it was a moment, a religious moment in the history of the State of Israel. Secular Jews blowing shofar, dancing, crying, not knowing that you read some of these reports time and again, each of these reports from secular Israelis were, I'm not a religious person. I never felt anything religious in my life. I don't even believe in God, many of them were saying. But that day that I stood at the Kotel hearing the shofar, I became a believer, or I felt something stir within me. There was something that happened. There was a unity and a unity of religion, and something about the Kotel created this kechubra layachdav. And sadly, we're losing it on many fronts. Sadly, the Kotel has become a polarizing force, where it should be a unifying force. We have a real problem with the Kotel, because it has to be a base tefillah. And to be a base tefillah, we have to have a certain way to daven, obviously. But on the other hand, that type of davening offends or distracts or distances people who are not used to that davening, don't want that davening. And we want the Kotel to be a unifying force, but it also has to be a base tefillah. It's easy to make a monument somewhere and have it be a unifying force, but the Kotel is the only monument, is the only area that will unify people. And it's your horn from Jews. It's not enough for me to go to the Kotel on Friday morning and daven and be happy that there are, I don't know, 2,000 Hezra boys. Great. But maybe 2,000 Hezra boys there. There are 2,000 none from Israelis who aren't there and are feeling alienated from it. And I don't know the answer to that question. But just because you don't know the answer to a question doesn't mean you're not haunted by it. You're not worried by it. And in 67, we had it. And we're starting to lose it. There are all sorts of solutions that we've thought about. But unfortunately, a lot of politics and myopia. How can we turn the Kotel that maintain the integrity of davening? Obviously, that's the starter. But still create an inviting environment for people to feel unified by it. It's really hard. We're losing something else. In 67, the Kotel jump-started this. I think it's one of the turning points in Israeli demography. The original secular Israel wasn't just secular. I told you this last week. The original secular Israel was anti-religious, anti-establishment, anti-tradition, anti-Torah, anti-rabbis. It was the old secular Zionists in the shtetl who fought tooth and nail against the rabbinic establishment, who despised God, who despised religion, who saw religion as shameful, saw the exile. And it's no wonder that a large section of Orthodox Jews said, okay, let's go to war. I don't mean go to war in a military sense, but let's face off against this secular establishment. How do we dare join them as partners? You Datilomi people, what are you thinking? That's not the demographic of most of secular Israel of 2013. I'll tell you why I said 2013. You'll see in a minute. The demographic of most secular Israel of 2013 is a much more traditional Jew, called Masorati, much more kind and embracing of religion, not necessarily ritual and halacha, but of religion. They'll make kiddush and then drive to the basketball game. They'll go to the beach. They won't eat chametz, but it's like they'll eat, be makbid on kibratz or something. They don't have this buster and chum. Their homes are kosher. Someone mentioned to me, one of the rabbanim said, I think it was in a Haredi yeshiva, it was very appropriately said, they're worrying about the kashrus in the hotel. So the rabbi said, trust me, your average chiloni household in Israel over Pesach is a lot more kosher than hotels. Because most of the food in Israel is kosher l'Pesach, and unless you really go out of your way to make it chametz, it's kosher l'Pesach. Whereas in hotels, it's hard to know what food's coming in, what food's coming out. They told them, you know what, you could probably show up in your average chiloni house in Tel Aviv, and you'd be keeping Pesach a lot more, so don't get all caught up in it. If you make the decision to go to a hotel, it's a decision you've made. That wasn't the point. The point wasn't about kashrus and Eretz Yisrael. And that started in 1967. 1967, to me, is where the demographic began to change. A lot of people will point to 1977, the election of Begin and Likud, as a shift of power from the original old labor Ashkenazi elite to the now Sephardic, more traditional Jew. I think 77 comes from 67. 77 is a political manifestation of this surge in religious spirit of 1967. Now I said 2013 because sadly we're ruining it. Sadly we're gambling away a lot of that spirit and a lot of that affection and a lot of that support that we gained. I remember when I came to Israel in 1993 and I made Aliyah and I bought my first used car. It wasn't a picnic. Buying a used car just off the boat, just off the plane. And I found two women like in Rehovot who sold me the car or something. A mother and a daughter were driving to get the car signed or something. And it's like, what are you going to do? I said, I wasn't a Rebbe. Then I'm learning in a yeshiva. What yeshiva are you learning in? Yeshiva Nahar. They like to stop the car. Take the car, don't pay. Atem Eser, you Hasdernikim, you won the war, you won the Lebanon war, you guys are amazing. Like, just, I'll pay you to take the car. You can't, we were rock stars. I remember being a rock star. You're walking on the Kippah Sugah, the whole place, like, can I get your autograph? And then a lot of hostility and a lot of antagonism and a lot of is what keeps me up at night. Short-term accomplishments, long-term loss. Short term, you can ram your political agenda down someone's throat, but at some point it's going to boomerang. And coercion never ends well. Never ends well. So you can either fight for legislation, you can fight for people's hearts. And if you really care about your people, the heart now. I'm not saying it shouldn't be considered legislation in certain areas. We have to legislate, but just has to be some balance. There has to be some balance. We're not fighting a war here. It's one family. Imagine in your family, if your father decides, these are the three kids I like, the three kids I don't like. Put the three kids we don't like in a chokehold and torture them. They got to sit, they got to hold on to the car in the back with their roller skating. No one wins. No one wins in a family unless the family's some degree of fraternity. And we're losing it. That's why I said 2013. I hate to see it. Just the anger, the hostility. Just those. I was watching this news clip the other night. There's some yeshiva that was open in Tel Aviv, and it's the most kind. It seems to me the most kind. Malot Eliyahu. You can look it up. Most kind-hearted as the yeshiva. They're involved in social activities. They're involved in Mada and Magid David Adom, and they serve. And it's like a regular as the yeshiva. It may not be as, I don't know, as Torah Mada as Yeshiva Arizona. Who knows? Look at the kids. Regular as the yeshiva. No one's that in high. And somehow the local Tel Aviv population got wind of the fact they wanted to open a yeshiva. They're starting to protest, and you're cult and messianic, and you're trying to. They're like the nicest kids in the world, but just there's such anti-religious sentiment. There's such hostility. The second you see a kippah, any kippah now, Haredi, Dati, Lumi, it's killing our country. And in 67, we had that moment, and unfortunately we failed to capitalize on it. So the first domestic impact amongst the Jewish people is what it did to the land of Israel, not just the religious revival, but remember I mentioned before how backward the country was in 1948 and 1950 in the wars of attrition? 67 was the turning point. 67 was when the country started the process of recovery, of economic growth, of military might, of diplomatic embrace. And we are looking to see how did Israel of 2023, someone showed me about 6-7 years ago a table mapping like 10 or 20 economic indexes or indices. GDP and per capita income, and I'm not an economist, but if you line up 20 indicators of economic growth, and like the amount, the percentage of change between, I think it was 1973 and 2013, whatever, 1970, it was like a 40-year span. The numbers were just abnormal. 300% change, 2,015% change, 800% improvement. You don't see numbers like that. Normally you're accustomed to numbers, at least not in my bank account. 8%, 10%, wow, 20%, 35%. I've never seen a 2,015%. I don't even know what it means. What does it mean to grow by 2,015%? But those are the real numbers of the state of Israel, the economic change and the growth and the military. So when did Israel go from being a banana republic, a third world country, to being a major military superpower? It started in 1967 because of the unity, because of the growth, because of the miracles, because of Yad Hashem. And that's the second impact of our return to Yerushalayim. It's not just the unity, but being in Yerushalayim means we are now aligned. Think of the world as being aligned. The people of God, in the city of God, underneath the throne of God. Am Yisrael, in Yerushalayim, Machal Neshiftecha, underneath the Shechina. Once we are in alignment with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, good things happen. And everyone notices, because everyone knows things are changing. The third, I'll go back, I'll summarize in the end. The third issue that changed. My grandfather left White Russia in 1922-23, and he single-handedly changed and saved my entire family. I don't know if you know the one of the boys that said the Davins for the Amud. Okay, the two boys, one is PJ, the other boy is an Israeli boy. His mother is actually my cousin. She's actually a Taragan. Sometimes he wears a shirt that says Taragan. His mother is from one of the family reunions or something. Or my third, fourth cousin. Anyone today who's Ashkenazi, who's walking around with the word named Taragan, and I believe as far as I know they're old Dati, has my grandfather to thank. Because he got up as a single Jew from Russia in 1922, moved to America, saved his pennies, kept Shabbos, and brought over family member by family member. Why am I saying this to you? Not just to take family pride. I've had a good lot of that also. And I keep telling you, the real heroic decisions are not the ones that make the headlines. The real heroic decisions are oftentimes, more often than not, quiet decisions that you take with no one noticing, whose impact and repercussions are only felt 100 years later. So you go back and read the headlines of whatever it was, November 10th, 1922, whatever my grandfather moved, I'm sure he didn't make the front lines of the Buffalo Gazette or the Detroit Evening, Oscar David Aragon moves to America. No one knew. But believe me, that decision that he took, quiet as it was a lot more impactful in history than anything that happened in any Congress or Parliament, because decrees, legislations, policies, leaders, headlines come and go. I'm not telling you you shouldn't be involved in politics. Some people decide to be involved, some not to be involved, but don't become intoxicated with it. Don't become drunk with it. Don't think that that's what the real history is being determined. The real history is being determined by moral actions, religious actions, family actions. you can decide that you want to also affect the process through politics. It's just a fine decision. But don't get all drunk on it. Don't get lost. Don't get lost in yourself. Now, there was one sibling who stayed behind, my grandfather's sister, Pesa Bluma, if you're interested in history. And we all heard stories of Pesa Bluma being gobbled up by the Soviet Union. And of course, the Soviet Union gobbled up all these Jews and scrubbed their identity. Nothing. Judaism, nothing. Zero. Except for a little Chabad is one of the great, great extinctions of ideology in history. Just think about it. The Spaniards couldn't even do it. As much as they tried, as hard as they tried, they couldn't extinguish. The Russians did a pretty good job. The Soviet did a pretty good job. And we all heard stories. Sharansky talks about the fact that when he grew up and he was Jewish, he didn't even know what it meant to be Jewish. Like, if you ask him, like, I'm saying, what does that even mean? It's like telling you, you're not an alien, being an alien, I don't know. You're a Jew. Oh, the only thing he knew is that people hated him. When he went to school, they made fun of him for being a Jew. Like, why are you making fun of me? I don't know. So I'm saying, you're fat, you're ugly, you've got acne. I don't know, they made fun of me for being Jewish. Okay, like little kids make fun of each other. I remember Pesa Bluma's son, Jakub, who was a Communist Party member, coming to visit my family in Flatbush in the 70s and having breakfast at our table. Sitting with his big leather suitcase at the table, I was absolutely sure that there was an atom bomb in that suitcase because I saw all the James Bond movies and I was ready to run under the table with my head. I was ready, and the second he said, Moshe, pass the butter. And I was wrong. I threw it at him. I'll give you the butter, I'll give you the cream cheese, and Jakob, just don't blow me up. Just take whatever you want. And Jakob gave me a toy tank and it had like a yellow, red communist star on it. It had a moving turret. And I brought it to school and I shot all my friends. And then like 3 days it ran out of batteries and I went to the store to replace it. And they opened up the back and it had a Russian battery in it, which were very different than my Duracell AAA batteries. So I had to toss the tank in the garbage after 3 days. Why am I saying all this? Okay. One of the greatest miracles and one of the biggest transformations of the state of Israel over the last 75 years is a very quiet revolution that a lot of people aren't aware of. We take anyone in. That's our job. We take Americans, with all the glory of Nefesh B'Nefesh, and I'm a little bit of an insider on this one, a little prejudice, but the numbers are still, how many North Americans have made Aliyah in 75 years? What are the numbers? 400,000? Not that much. Far more impactful other than Aliyot. But Aliyah is a stressor. When you take in Ethiopians, and it's our job to take in Ethiopians, these are people who are coming from a third world country without education, from a different culture, and it stresses society, it stresses the economy, it stresses the social fabric, unfortunately. But one of the biggest transformations for our country was 1.5 million Russians emigrating to Israel, more or less between 1990 and, let's say, 2004. Initially, it stressed the economy because you can't take in 30% of your own population, whatever it was. But ultimately, these were high-class, educated people from a first-world country, used to a high quality of life, scientifically oriented. You want to know how we became a startup nation? You have Russia and Aliyah to thank. You want to know how we solved our economics? You know how much a bag of milk would cost? I mean, you guys don't even know what a bag of milk is because you guys are all spoiled with cartons and milk. We used to buy bags of milk. You know how much a bag of milk cost? You're going to laugh. 60,000 shekel. On Monday. And on Tuesday, the price rose to 70,000 shekel because we lived in the bizarre world of hyperinflation, of banana republic economy. We used to run, I remember, to the makola right after Shacharit and just dump all our money in the makola and pull things off the shelf as quickly as we could before the makola owner got a chance to increase the price because you have to increase the price every day. So we were buying today's goods at yesterday's prices, and we're saving like 10% because everything increased in price by 10% overnight until it basically Ravaran told us this is immoral. You shouldn't be doing that. McCullough isn't here to pat your fat American wallets. McCullough's here to service the people in the community. So we didn't know we were little kids. We just wanted to get the money. So you're right. So, and at some point, the McCullough made a rule. That, you know, they actually made a rule. The Yeshivikins aren't allowed to come shop at McCullough until 10 o'clock in the morning. Because they needed time to literally change the prices. People say, like, how'd you buy so many sfarim? You walk into my house. It was really simple. I promise you, it was more or less like this. I walk into a sfarim store in Mea Shearim. I come with two suitcases. I put $20 on the table. He'd say, take what you want, fill up your suitcases. And it didn't make a difference because prices didn't mean anything. Dollars meant something. Shekel was worthless. So the fact that it cost 20 shekel and 30 shekel was pointless because tomorrow they don't be the same. The 30 shekel will be more than anything anyway tomorrow. But the dollars was the only thing of durability. So I put the dollars, I think, which it wasn't more like that, but it's okay, take another one, take a few more. It was just give me the dollars. Yeah, it reached the point where they started to price things in dollars. There were certain stores you walked into, there was a price in dollars. And how did we recover from those zany economies? Well, two things. First of all, the great hero, the unsung hero, was someone that a lot of people don't remember, Shimon Peres. Shimon Peres became the finance minister and he introduced the program of austerity. Shimon Peres is responsible for two of the greatest accomplishments in the history of the state of Israel. One is he led the nuclear team to discover, to acquire nuclear weapons in the 50s and 60s. Two is he solved, not just him, other people, but he was on the team that solved inflation. But Peres wouldn't have been successful if we didn't have the greatest resource, because we didn't have money, we don't have oil, we don't have minerals, we had nothing. Then all of a sudden we discovered in the 21st century we have the best resource. It's called human resources. And that's where we became a startup nation. And that's the resource that beats all resources. And we got 1.5 million of them coming into our country. So how did we go from my aunt being gobbled up by Soviet communism to 1.5 million Jews returning to Israel? There's one answer. The cackling sound coming over the Voice of America radio, which was American radio broadcasting to Russians under the Soviet Union to give them real information, VOA, the cackling voice of the broadcaster broadcasting over VOA, the Jews are back in Yerushalayim. They've beaten the Syrians in the desert. They've beaten the Egyptians in Sinai. Har Habayis b'yadeinu. Something happened when they found out that we're back in Yerushalayim. It was the greatest anthropological miracle in the history of mankind. All of a sudden, the entire icicle called Russia melted. And that's when the movement to return began. That's when Sharansky started. That's when all the Soviet refuseniks started. Before 67, nothing, zero. No one's saying, I want to go to Israel. No one's going to jail to be in Israel. No one's hijacking planes to go to Israel. Nothing. And in 1967, when they heard something electrified, Ki'ir Shechur B'lei Achdav, is some shockability of this city. It changes Judaism. It changes Jewish identity. It links and infuses people to some larger collective historical sense. I wrote an article a couple years ago for the Post. I called it A City of Magnets. It magnetizes people. It's something that you can't hold back when you're being attracted to it. And like I said earlier, it didn't just change the Jewish world. The fact that we stood tall and defied Russian and defied the Soviet Union. In 1986, Sharansky walked across a bridge in some, what was it, a suburb of Munich, or was it Reinecke Bridge or something? I think it was near Munich or near Berlin. And 3 years later, the Soviet Union fell. You don't think there's a relationship between Jewish defiance of the Soviet Union and the fall of the Soviet Union? We're the only people who dared defy them. Czechs didn't, and Hungarians failed, and all the Serbs failed, and all the Yugoslavs. And we decided once, because that's what we do, we blow away these totalitarian regimes, whether it's Nebuchadnezzar or Haman or the Soviet Union. Can you imagine if you were given a DeLorean with one setting and you could go back in time? So if you're really firm, you go back in time to a place of Jewish history so you can pass my interview question. But if you want to make some dough, some good moolah, some mucho dinero, I would go back to Vegas. Okay, so you can bet on all the Super Bowls and all the World Cups, you know who won. But if you're looking for really good odds, you go back to Vegas in 1960, let's say, and go take a bet. Who's going to last longer? The Soviet Empire or the State of Israel? I think you get pretty good odds on the Soviet Union lasting longer than the State of Israel. Put down a couple bucks, say, I think the State of Israel is going to last longer. A lot of people cackle at you, a lot of people laugh at you. General people laugh at you, you know you're doing the right thing. You walk out of Vegas, you wait a couple of years, and you're a rich man. You're richy rich. Soviet Union lasted 69 years. We're working on our 75th. Soviet Union built the last 1,000 years, crushing authority. They come and go. They come and they go. So 1967 rippled northward and eastward to Moscow. It didn't just change the way the world viewed us, and it didn't just change the internal fabric of Jewish Israeli society. Change Jews. But here's the real kicker, and I hope I have enough time, only 10 minutes, but I want to make sure I convey it to you properly. Change everyone in this room. I don't see any Russians here. No one, kind of, any Russians? They don't come from Russia? No. to all good old Western Jews, whether you live in the West or you live in South Africa, they're all Western Jews. How to change Western Jewry? Well, you see, there's this very, very toxic sentiment that happens to a lot of kids your age. A lot of kids your age come to Israel, and they get very religious, as they should. They're very inspired, as they should. They turn around and look at their parents. You guys, you were mixed dancers. You went to girlfriends. I don't know, you went to beaches. I don't know, you guys, modern Orthodox Jews, that were frilly. You guys were half Jews. The thing Rabbi Soloveitchik talked about, not real. I've heard that some yeshivas actively promote this, to look back negatively upon your parents and your grandparents because they weren't as firm as you. I'm here to tell you, that's not just repugnant, it's also ignorant. That grandfather I told you about is really from the firmest shul in Baltimore, which is the firmest town in America. He started a club. He called the Shomer Shabbos Club in the 20s. He ended up big pins. They wore big pins. I'm the Shomer Shabbos. I don't want to be in that close. It's too nerdy. But whatever. We're big pins. You know how many people in the Shomer Shabbos Club in Baltimore? Two. Three. Three people kept Shabbos in Baltimore. That's how hard it was to keep Shabbos. It took more heroism for your grandfather to keep Shabbos, your great-grandfather at this point, depending upon how old you are, than any mesechta you'll finish, and no matter how firm you are, you don't know how hard it was to be firm. And you can just punch in the word South Africa on steroids. People believe in religion. And in Australia, if your father were a kippah in public, or for your grandfather a kippah, I don't care how firm you're going to be. That's how hard it was to be firm. And here's the point, which is why I began that way. Modern Orthodoxy, whatever you think about it, I'm not here to convince you of it, to diss it, I don't care, you know, I don't care about these titles. But modern Orthodoxy saved Orthodoxy in America. Every single boy learning in Lakewood and every single boy learning in any yeshiva in America has Rabbi Soloveitchik and modern Orthodoxy to thank. Even if you don't think it's the right way to serve Rabbi Shmarek in 2022, because that was the only form of Orthodoxy that washed, that worked in the 50s and 60s in America under the pressure that they felt. Because it was the type of Orthodoxy that people could swallow, could handle. I can still be firm and still be part. You don't realize. Just like you don't realize how hard it was to avoid Avodah Zarah. You look back at the old day of Avodah Zarah and you laugh. What do you care? Remember the Gemara says, Rav Ashi once said, we're going to talk about our good friend Menashe tomorrow and how much he worshipped Avodah Zarah. And Menashe came to him in a dream and said, how dare you judge our generation? You just can't imagine how seductive Avodah Zarah was in a world of fear and uncertainty and unpredictability. And we needed things to hold on to. You can't imagine how hard it was to be from. How much heroism and courage it took for people. How the only brand of Yiddishkeit that people were even willing to consider when everyone just assumed that Orthodoxy was on the ropes was, okay, tell me, can I still be part of the world? Can I still be accepted in the world? Can I have a half a beard so I can hide my beard? Or goatee, the old goatee shot. When you want a beard, you have it. You hold your hands like this. When you don't want a beard, you hold your hands like this. Right? It's iconic. The rope had the goatee. So a lot of people in that generation had a goatee. Why? Because if you don't have a beard, you just hold your hands like this. If you want to look like you have a beard, then hold your hands like this. So you can both have a beard and not have a beard, which is, of course, a joke and a metaphor. You can be in both worlds. So I don't care. You can get up and say, I think modern Orthodoxy is the work of the devil. Modern Orthodoxy is corrupt. Modern Orthodoxy is terrible. I don't care. You can believe that. But in 1950, it saved Judaism. And there won't be a Lakewood in 2020 if there weren't modern Orthodoxy in 1950. I'm telling you this so that you appreciate how different the world that you live in is than the world that even I lived in. I didn't learn in the summer. And I bet I even know that people learned in the summer. I had a couple choice words for people who learned in the summer. I won't tell you what we used to call them. Believe me, my summers were not surrounding Torah or ideas or Moshava or Israel. Believe me, a lot of things put up in a lot of places of people's bodies and drugs and smoking and I don't know. There's a lot going on. I got a real education when I went, just to show you how bad it was. My parents didn't really know anything and they picked a camp out of a hat and I was the first one and I went to an old boys high school and I was really Jewish. So what do you think they picked out for me? My parents, they should live in Manhattan, Seneca Lake. Those of you know what I'm talking about. A lot of smoke. Let's just put it that way. I saw a lot of things that summer that I didn't know what was happening. Only afterwards, oh, That's what they were doing. Oh, okay, now I got it. The point was, NCSY, White Kollel, summer camp, and B'nai Akiva. Oh, who taught of these things? It was a different world. It wasn't cool to be from there. No, it was learning Torah. It's called greaseball. See, ever heard the phrase, ask your parents what a greaseball was? A greaseball was because we associated people who were religious with poor hygiene, that they didn't shower that much, and that their hair was very greasy and ugly, so we called them greaseballs. That was the go-to word to make fun of religious people on earth, because everyone knew it. Baruch Hashem, look at the world you live in, and people are coming and learning and growing in Avonis Hashem. And when did that all start? I'll tell you when it started. It started in 1967. Because in 1967, Jews in Chutz La'aretz started to feel more comfortable and more proud and more public. Because if we are proud and we have defeated and we are in Yerushalayim and we have our peoplehood back, and so now I can wear a yarmulke in public and now I can be part of the political system and now I can open it. Because when Jewish people feel pride, one of the expressions, especially for Orthodox people, is Torah mitzvah. It's part of a national expression. It's not like everything else. It takes a while for these things to settle and to develop. So it's not like all of a sudden in June 1968 everyone was learning in Lakewood, everyone was learning Daf Yomi. But as the generations started unfolding, people started coming to Israel more. That's when the big Aliyah from America began, and not just Aliyah. When I think about Western Jewry's investment in Israel, I think about it on two fronts. A, Aliyah. B, buying apartments. And don't tell anyone I told you that, because Jews from Teaneck or from Los Angeles who buy apartments in Israel are the sworn enemies of young Israeli couples. Why do they hate you? Because you buy the apartments in Yerushalayim. You don't live there. You drive up the real estate prices, and you force young Israeli couples to move to Ofakim or Tehran. That's what my kids talk about. Why are these rich Americans coming and buying up all the real estate in Yerushalayim and forcing us to live in the periphery? Okay, I don't tell my kids this. I'm happy. Because buying an apartment in Yerushalayim makes you a shareholder in our state, in our people. And even if you're not going to live here, you live here a day, a year, come for Yom Kippur, for Sukkot, whatever, you're still a shareholder. And the cost is, the real estate market is zany, but the benefit is, why do you think the real estate market is zany? Because this is the center of the world, and everyone knows that this is the front row seat to the end of history. You want a front row seat, you got to pay for it. I got a front row seat for the end of history. I'd rather get a front row seat to the end of history than the front row seat of Madison Square Garden to watch a couple people throw a ball through. So it costs money to have a front row seat. So it's not just that Russian Jewry was revitalized and galvanized by the Six-State War. Western Jewry, none of you would be in this room, literally and figuratively, if not for the Six-State War. The big, big, big pilgrimage of American and overseas programs and stuff, African, all that thing, began in 67. Who came before 67? Drips and drabs. A person here, a person there. So none of you would be in this room. Tzvi, your parents wouldn't have made Aliyah. I probably wouldn't have made Aliyah. We may be visiting for our first year in college to go to Hebrew U. This whole revival of yeshivos and visiting and Aliyah and coming to Israel and the backwash and how it affects our communities and the revival. There are many, many factors. Obviously, sociologists can point to factors and statisticians can point to factors and economists and demographers, but we're looking for the spirit, right? We're people with spirit. Spiritual people look for spirit. The spirit that drives this engine is the spirit of 1967, is the spirit of Yerushalayim. Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem. Nidchei Yisrael Yechanes. When did Nidchei Yisrael start to gather in Yerushalayim? There's Yisrael only after Bonei Yerushalayim. Without Yerushalayim, pre-67, there's no Nidchei Yisrael Yechanes. After Yerushalayim, Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem, Nidchei Yisrael Yechanes. That's when the people who were pushed away, whether they were pushed away because they were in the Soviet Union, whether they were pushed away because they were living under Western influence where you're afraid to express your Judaism, whether you are Nidchei Yisrael because you are a secular Israeli who for whatever reason couldn't swallow Judaism after the Holocaust. There's so many types of Nidchei Yisrael, but all of them started to be Nichanes after Yerushalayim. So all of them started to gather after Yerushalayim was returned. And that's the second part. So I want you to try to process this day along two fronts. One front is forget Yerushalayim. Just think about Yeshua Hashem. Let's say the war took place, I don't know. Hashem saved us from a pogrom in Russia. Hashem saved us from a pogrom. Make it as least historical, least Israeli as possible. All the nations were, I'm using the word pogrom intentionally, take it out of the Israeli context. All the nations were assembling for a pogrom, for a Holocaust, for a massacre, for a crusade. And unlike all the other moments in Jewish history we weren't in Eretz Yisrael, Hashem rescued us in a miraculous fashion and redrew the map. Don't mention that you had war, you were so clean, just to make sure that you're able to process it on its own. And then, by the way, all of a sudden, history changed, we turned, and you all know by now that when I use the word Yerushalayim, I don't just mean Yerushalayim. I mean Yerushalayim. It is important to say with this I'll end, and the entire biblical corridor which surrounds it, which is the Sefer of Bereishis. That biblical corridor is where Bereishis unfolded. Bereishis didn't take place in Tel Aviv, it didn't take place in Haifa. Avram visited probably Ashkelon and Ashdod, but only to visit his friend Avimelech. It happened in a corridor that begins in the north, in Beit El Shechem, where Avram comes, Elom Moreh. It snakes its way down, of course, to Yerushalayim, intersects with Beit Lechem, which will be tomorrow with Hashem, and Kever Rachel, right through the Gush, right through this room. I can see it right here, snaking through Derech Avos, to Hebron, to Beersheba. That's the biblical corridor. That's what Sefer Bereishis. When we don't have the biblical corridor, history is still stuck in the mud. When we do have the biblical corridor, everything is different. They know it, we know it, and that's why our hold in Yerushalayim is so contested. They don't care if we're in Haifa. They care that we're in Yerushalayim. Okay, so please, take the time, invest in it. When you're in yeshiva, when you're dancing, when you're saying Hallel, the Kotel, whatever your plans are. I know it's a hodgepodge of a day because it's there of Shabbos. But again, it's a very muted, you're not going to have the same national energy next year, whenever you're in Chisar. It's not like it's going to be on all the billboard. Maybe you'll see a little note in the shul, Yom Yerushalayim. So I think it's more mental. It's more to study, to understand, and to think about how Jewish history was changed in 67. Okay?
You're welcome.